You're listening to New England Public Media News. I'm Adam Frenier, and this is the shortlist NEPM's Week in Review. Joining us today on the line, Mike Dobbs, managing editor of the Reminder Newspapers, and Elizabeth Roman, reporter and editor with the Springfield Republican and El Pueblo Latino. Mike, Liz, it's good to have you on today.
Good to be here.
Hi.
This week, Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker praised the job several communities are doing to flatten the COVID-19 curve, and he singled out Springfield's efforts to bring the city's risk level back for the coronavirus from moderate to low. Here's Baker.
Dom Sarno, who's the mayor in Springfield, has been incredibly aggressive about messaging and communicating and encouraging people to do the things that work.
Mike, how about the efforts of Springfield officials in battling COVID-19?
I think that everyone here has been taking it extremely seriously. The mayor has his weekly COVID press conferences where he brings in all sorts of people. And I think that he has been very aggressive in trying to deal with this. And I think that in a city with a high rate of poverty, in a city where, you know, maybe taking COVID precautions isn't necessarily the top of mind awareness for everyone, I think that he and his administration have done a very good job, and I'm glad that the governor pointed it out.
Liz, at the same press conference, Baker also blasted an unemployment relief plan by President Trump, saying it's not sustainable. He also called on congressional leaders from both parties to come together on another relief bill. What did you make of these comments from the governor?
I mean, I think he was just expressing what the people are feeling, just what average residents are feeling about fear of not knowing if they're going to have a check for more than a couple weeks. A lot of places still are not open or only partially open and, you know, can't accommodate a full-time employment. So I actually felt that he expressed himself in the way that his constituents would have wanted him to.
Meanwhile, in Connecticut, the Hartford Current reports about a dozen school districts after reopening for in-person learning have had cases of COVID-19, and there's no clear mandate from the state whether schools should stay open after a case has been detected. The Current reports some schools have shut down while others have stayed open, asking those in contact with infected people to quarantine. Liz, there's guidelines to follow, but does Connecticut need to do more to guide schools on this?
I mean, I don't know. I can really speak to what Massachusetts is doing, which is pretty similar, where every school is doing their own thing. And I think that's the only way it can be done because every school has a different circumstance. You have some school districts that have 2,000 kids and other school districts that have 30,000 kids. So you can't set the same rules for kids in Hartford that you would set for maybe kids in Bloomfield or Enfield.
And Liz, you mentioned what Massachusetts officials are doing. Some of the steps include consulting with the local Board of Health, looking at metrics for the town involved, and working with the state when they do want to consider closing school if there's a COVID-19 outbreak. But just like Connecticut, there's no hard and fast rule about when schools must close. Mike, schools are starting to open in Massachusetts. Are there things that school officials here can learn about what's going on in Connecticut?
Well, I think that the big takeaway is to try to translate all of the precautions that we've taken in our daily lives and put them in a school setting. And I think the difficulty with that is that whereas you can have a little bit more control in an office space or workspace or home, it's really tough to have that control when you're talking about a classroom full of kids, even if the kids are high school kids. So, yes, I think that Massachusetts education officials have been looking toward other states to see what they've been doing. And I think that the general attitude is, especially with remote learning, is that we'd rather be safe than sorry. I think they feel that they can catch the kids up educationally later on in the year and make sure at this time of the year they're not being unduly exposed to COVID-19.
We shift now to politics. Looking back at last week's Massachusetts primaries, there were a couple of races for federal offices which took a negative tone, especially as the election got closer. Mike, you wrote about this in a column this week with the headline, "Candidates Smear Each Other and It's Shameful." Would you tell us a little bit more?
Well, I do think that what we saw in both the Neil Morris race and with the race between Markey and Kennedy was that having positive messages didn't seem to be enough. So here he had a congressman, Richard Neal, who had not campaigned negatively, who wound up getting this PAC support, with negative messaging toward Morse. It was this after Morse's PAC support started negatively messaging Neil. I think ultimately it became almost a blur for voters. All of this back and forth, one accusation from another, followed by another accusation. And I did think it was shameful. And I did think that there were commercials that did not accurately portray the background of some of these candidates.
Liz, what's your take on this?
Honestly, I pay a lot of money on all of my apps so that I don't have to see commercials. So I didn't see too many of the negative ads. I try and stay away from them, but obviously they would show up on Twitter or Instagram or if I'm watching TV occasionally. And frankly, I think the voters are really intelligent now. They have so many avenues for which they can find information about candidates. They can do their own digging, their own research. So I don't know that it played a role in terms of, having people learn new horrible things about the candidates, but it maybe played a role in deciding, do you want a person in Congress or it representing you that is willing to play dirty like that?
And finally, this week, today marks 19 years since the 9/11 attacks took place, the single deadliest instance of a terror attack in world history. Commemorations were held locally today in Springfield and Westfield and other places, as well as all across the country. Liz, as you look back to what happened nearly two decades ago, what are some of your reflections?
Well, actually, I was at a memorial service this morning in West Springfield where Melissa Harrington Hughes was a West Springfield native who died in the North Tower. It's a harrowing story. She called her dad and talked to him right before she passed, and she called her husband as well. So, you know, it's 19 years and you think, oh, it was so long ago. But being there at that ceremony today, it was really raw for a lot of people. And it just reminds you of where you were in that moment, what it meant to us as a country, what it meant about our politics, the things we learned that maybe we didn't know about the way we were operating in other countries. So, yeah, I think it's still fresh for a lot of people, even 19 years later.
Mike?
I think that the impact of that event we are feeling, as Liz just said, I think we're feeling it today. We're going to continue feeling it. We feel it in foreign policy issues. We feel it about how we look at one another. We feel it about issues like freedom of religion. So it made a huge impact on American culture, on American politics, and it has, I really don't think it's subsided its effects after 19 years.
Mike Dobbs with the reminder and Elizabeth Roman with the Springfield Republican and El Pueblo Latino, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The Shortlist, NEPM's Week in Review. Remember, you can catch us at any time wherever you get your podcasts or at nepm.org/podcasthub. I'm Adam Frenier, and this is New England Public Media.